welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I am Tyler Smith.
I am David Bax.
And thank you for listening. David.
Yes.
Happy New Year, almost.
That's right. Happy New Year, almost. Right? Yeah, I'm trying to think when I should... This might go up early.
Okay.
Or maybe, you know what? I might just put it up late.
Okay.
People are busy anyway.
That's true.
It might already be 2024 by the time I post this.
Okay. Well, then Happy New Year for real.
Happy New Year for real.
Maybe. So,
look, I got a lot of plans. I'm a happening guy about town, you know.
Yeah.
It's the holiday season, as Frank Sinatra said. Is that who? It's the holiday season. Is that Sinatra? I can't remember who that is. Maybe it's Dean Martin. I don't know.
I mean, I could see it being like all those guys recorded everything.
Right. Yeah.
You know? Yeah, that's the one where it goes, so whoop-dee-doo, and Dickory Doc.
Yeah.
And it's just like, whoop-dee-doo. And also, Dickory Doc, it's not a thing people say.
Yeah, but that is, like, very Frank Sinatra to, like...
Oh, for sure.
Throw things in the... I remember, I think I mentioned on a recent episode, maybe a couple of recent episodes, that I watched through this, like, DVD box set of, like, Mel Brooks TV appearances. Yeah. And he did his impression of, like, Sinatra doing Springtime for Hitler. And he did throw a bunch of, like, skibbity-doos in there and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's one, like, let's see. What do you do, Dickory Doc? And don't forget to hang up your sock.
Yeah.
And it's like, so you couldn't rhyme anything with sock. Like, that's, you had to come up with nonsense. All right, fair enough.
Well, that also reminds me of, because it's the holiday season, there's been a lot of, I've been listening to a lot of Christmas music. I went through a period of, like, being too cool for Christmas, but for the past, like, 10, 12 years, like, love it. I love Christmas. So I've been listening to a lot of Christmas music, and every time I listen to It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas, I think of you. Because when Perry Como says, Mom and Dad can hardly wait for school to start again.
Yeah, that's right.
You always, like, got mad at that line.
Yeah. Like, fuck you.
We're having fun as a family.
Yeah. It's like, don't speak for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, and so speaking of Christmas, I've got a story for you, David.
Oh, okay.
And that story will lead into what I want to talk about at the top here.
Okay.
And so it's probably... I want to say it was probably 5 years ago, and I was teaching high schoolers getting college credit. And it was like, I think it was the last, maybe second to last class of the fall semester. So it was into December. So, you know, people are talking about Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the kids said, like, what's your favorite Christmas movie? And I said, it's hard to choose, but probably Charlie Brown Christmas. And also, like, I don't know why I feel guilty when I say Muppet Christmas Carol, but I love it. And then a guy, like, raised his hand, and he goes, I have a question for you. And you could just tell on his face. And I was like, are you about to ask me if Die Hard's is a Christmas movie? And he's like, yeah, how'd you know? It's like, because everybody talks about that. And this was fucking... four or 5 years ago. I'm done with this thing. I'm fucking done with it. Everybody talks about it like it's some new thing. Like, I don't like the idea of there being this, like, perennial debate, especially because everyone seems to treat it like it's the first time anybody thought of it. And it's exhausting.
Right now, you're part of the problem because you're bringing it up again. We've talked about this in Christmas's past.
I know, but that's the thing is, like, everyone just keeps talking about it, like,
and I'm saying,
like, on
the
Facebook.
The solution is to...
It's just ignore it?
Just ignore it.
I don't know, man. I think there's just something about, like, every Christmas I see it, like, at least 8 or 9 times. And everyone's like, all right, guys, let's settle this. It's like, you're not settling shit, all right?
Yeah.
You're going to do the same shit the next year. Like, I'm part of, like a dad's Facebook group. And so...
God.
There is a... Which I use, which actually,
awful.
Oh, I find it very helpful.
Okay.
Like, people throw out, like, hey, what are you guys going to tell your kids about Santa Claus? And it's like, and the kids are, my kids are getting to that age where it's like, yeah, what are we going to do about Santa Claus?
Do they share, like, dad jokes? Because that I would love.
It's rare, but yes.
Do you know there's a movie that premiered at Toronto this year called How to Have Sex that is not about dads at all, but it has... There's a part where two characters are drunkenly telling corny jokes to each other and has one of my favorite dad jokes that I've ever heard.
Which is
that we're getting rid of our vacuum cleaner. It's just been collecting dust.
That's pretty good. I like that. So one guy said, like, so guys, what do you think? Is Die Hard a Christmas movie? And I just... And I wanted to type, like, enough. Stop it.
But I'm saying...
We don't need this anymore.
You're giving oxygen to the fire right now. Let's just ignore it. Let's just move on.
I feel like if I gave oxygen... Like, the way to give oxygen to the fire is to take a stand one way or the other. And be really, like, final about it. Like, if you... it's the idea of, like... Like, no, answering the question one way or another is what gives it the fire... is what feeds the fire. But like, if you just say this is a question that should no longer be asked,
but I think we lost that battle.
I know, I just don't get it. Like, is I can't be the only one that's like tired of this.
You're not. That's why I don't
see anybody else saying this,
because they're doing what I'm doing and just like letting it happen over there.
So you're saying there's
staying
like
staying out of it,
like a silent majority.
Yeah, I think a silent majority have decided how they feel about it. Like you said, yeah, I'm not going to... I've said on this podcast my feelings on it before. We're not going to give it fire.
Yeah.
Or give the fire any oxygen this year.
I don't know why I'm so angry, but I am. I'm so angry. And there are so many other things in the world to be angry about, and yet somehow this just keeps getting me.
I don't know what to tell you.
Sorry, everybody, to waste your time.
Yeah, everyone who's listening to this has probably already come to a decision about it. Hopefully, just kept it to themselves. Don't care anymore.
Yeah. I don't remember what her last name is now, but my friend Jennifer Freeman, who you know from Bus Stop.
Yeah.
One of the actors.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Never mind. I was very confused by what you said.
Oh, yeah, because she got married. I don't remember her last name now.
But
I want to say it's like Hornbeck or something.
This is a dumb, like, now that they didn't change her name, we got married, and I still, like, forget that people, like, I still forget that people do, I guess?
Yeah.
And, like, I remember asking, I asked Frank, Feel My Wrath McGrath.
Yeah.
For some reason, I can't remember if I was, like, trying to like tag her on Instagram or something, and I was like, what's your wife's last name again? And he was like, McGrath.
Right. Yeah, that's something that almost everyone we know has done. But nonetheless, she and I went to high school together in our senior year. We were in The Lion in Winter. Uh-huh. And so she posted a photo on my wall of a still from the movie of Peter O'Toole and Katharine Hepburn laughing. And it says, and like the thing said at the bottom, like, it's like something to the degree of, it's like, and they think Die Hard is an edgy Christmas movie. And because like it does take place at Christmas.
Yeah.
And it's like so dysfunctional.
Yeah. But I think we just don't need to have any debates anymore. Die Hard's a Christmas movie if you want it to be.
Aladdin's
a Christmas movie if you want it to be.
Yeah.
Tangerine's a Christmas movie if you want it to be. Eyes Wide Shut is a Christmas movie if you want it to be.
Sure.
All of these, it's fine.
Yeah. Iron Man 3.
No one's making these rules. Yeah. Actually, on Christmas today, we went to, like we always do, went to a bar with friends on Christmas Day, and someone was saying A Long Kiss Goodnight should be.
Sure.
It's all Shane Black movies.
Shane Black, yeah.
It's Christmas and everything.
Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, sorry.
From my own, I understand. I've still never seen Leech
Weapon. Me neither.
I know. Mike Schmidt will be so mad at us.
I know.
It's been like 10 years.
Let's just...
haven't seen it.
Let's plant our flag on that. We're never watching Lethal Weapon.
I don't know.
But we can move on. Sorry, everybody.
Well, you know what? I'll do my top of show thing. To put the damper on the fire. And this will be multi-part. The first thing is our friend Jordan over at the film stage said in his write-up of his 10 best films of 2023 that 2023 is the best movie year since 2007. I would say that, like, while I say that I think 2011 and 2016 were both really good years, they get overlooked. There's no denying to me that 2023 is a stellar year.
You know.
But, I mean, you're only able to see what you're able to see.
Right. But I've seen, like, 80 movies.
Yeah.
And so, like, but me having access to what I have access to, most of the movies I've seen are extremely middle of the road, if that's not a contradiction in terms.
Right.
But,
but yeah, middle of the road.
Yeah, absolutely. But the so when I look at like my top 10, 15, it's like these are all pretty great. But at the same time, like I feel bad. I feel like my top 10 is super basic because it's all the movies that like everybody's talking about, like Holdovers and Oppenheimer and stuff like that. And I feel like usually my top 10 is a little bit more varied. But this year, just, I think because of the movies I have access to,
yeah, you only have access,
but
yeah.
Because of that, it feels to me like this is just like kind of just a regular humdrum year with like maybe eight movies that everyone thinks is great. But of course, there's more than that.
This is
but
what
I just haven't seen them.
Well, first off, yeah, looking at my top 10 as it currently stands, obviously we won't be doing our, top 10 on the podcast until the week before the Oscars, because that's our tradition, so I'll have time for it to change. But as my top 10 currently stands, I think you've only seen one of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I just don't think you've had the access to everything here. But what I really wanted to get into is like how late in the year I started to realize what a good year it was.
Yeah.
So here's what I'm going to say. Back, my first Sundance was 2016. And I'm going to drop a name here. It was the first time I ever met Jason Bailey, the film critic.
Okay.
The guy who wrote that GQ article about David Zaslav.
Yeah.
Start up a storm. Anyway, friend of a friend. It's not like we're like besties or anything.
Yeah.
But like, it being my first Sundance and him being a Sundance veteran, I remember asking him that year, does a good Sundance augur a good year for film? Hmm. And he wasn't quite sure. And I can say 2023 is the year that proves that no. There is, I think Sundance's scope is too narrow to predict the year. And I think that I don't know about best since 2007 or whatever, but I do think 2023 is a phenomenal year of movies. But 2023 Sundance was, for me, the weakest slate of any Sundance I've covered since 2016. With the exception of Past Lives.
Right.
There was nothing really that like made a huge mark for me. Even stuff that came out of Sundance that felt like it was going to make a big mark, like Fair Play kind of fizzled out.
Right.
Cat Person really fizzled out, even though I kind of liked it.
Yeah.
Magazine Dreams I hated, but obviously is not coming out now because of the Jonathan Majors thing. But a lot of people liked that. So like Past Lives is really the only one that broke through from Sundance. And so then you get to the summer and you had the Barbenheimer thing, and that felt special.
Yeah.
But one weekend is not a whole year.
Right.
I think it wasn't until I went to TIFF in early September.
Yeah.
I saw 15 movies at TIFF. I would say 13 of them were great, and the other two were good.
Yeah.
I think that was when I started to realize, like, wow. That like
I feel
what
like
a stellar year, and then AFI Fest, which was late October, also cemented it. Even I didn't see as many movies as I wanted to at AFI as I would have at AFI Fest because they stupidly scheduled AFI Fest over the weekend before Halloween, which is like I've got shit to do, you know, there's parties and stuff. So I didn't see everything there, but everything I saw at AFI Fest was good. And AFI Fest, I think, is again it's late in the year, but the nature of AFI Fest, which is sort of acts as the like best of the festivals for the whole year, is a good way of telling if a year is good. So it's interesting with the release pattern, how long it often takes, or at least long it took this year It took until mid-September for me to go, like, I think this might be a really good year.
Having not been to any of these festivals and just hearing, like, word of mouth, it does seem like over the last 10 years or so, it does feel like Toronto is more of an indicator than Sundance.
Yeah. I mean, I think Cannes is probably the real indicator.
Sure.
But I've said before that I can never go to Cannes. Okay. Because I know once I go once, I'm going to, like, rearrange my life to go every year. Yeah. It might cost me my job. It might cost me my marriage. I can't be someone who tries to go to Cannes every year. I'm exaggerating, obviously. Yeah. But, Cannes and Venice. And I guess Telluride. But, I mean, Telluride seems more like...
Yeah.
I mean, Telluride has a lot of, awards contenders, but it feels like it's mostly meant for the kind of stuff you're talking about that you're able to see, middle of the road awards type stuff.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, once you throw your net internationally, I think, 2023, just fantastic year. We'll see how it shapes up. But there are movies that are great that are going to be on a lot of people's lists that I agree are great that aren't even going to be honorable mentions for me because it's too dense a year for me.
I did have the thought the other day of, like, this might be a good year because I started noticing, like, what was in my number 16 spot. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, wow. Like, this is great. And it did not make my top 10. And, for example, like, Killers of the Flower Moon just got bumped out of my top 10. And that's great, along with several other movies.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I feel like I did have that thought the other day. Yeah. Like, you can't judge... I feel like you can't judge a movie year based on your top 10. You can base it on your top 20.
Yeah, because you can... Yeah, generally, if you look hard enough, you can find 10 great films any year. But, if you get to, like, top 20, top 30, and you're still in, like...
Yeah.
Great movie range, then so we've luckily killed a lot of time because
speaking of middle of the road Oscar movies, I feel like that'd be a good transition, although we have to do an ad.
Real quick, I want to tell you about tweakedaudio.com. Tweaked Audio is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great, they sound great. I use them each and every day of my life. This morning, while working from home, I'm on a half day today.
Mm-hmm.
This morning, I was listening to a new album by an Australian technical death metal band called The Ritual Aura. And the album, Heresiarch? Mm-hmm. I don't know how you pronounce it, but it's got a kick-ass dragon with a glowing plasma mouth on the cover. Very cool cover. And it sounds very good. It's a very textured album. A lot of times technical death metal can be very technical and not necessarily a lot of emotion or pathos, but there's a lot of varied instrumentation in this album, and a lot of it is intense, but also a lot of it is kind of pretty. So I really like The Ritual Aura's new album, which I don't know how to pronounce. And it sounded great on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds. They're available at a low, low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, we're back. It is, as you said, it is end of the year, catch-up, award season time. These are important movies.
Yeah.
These are the movies that are important, which brings us to... I feel like you and I as, like... Something turned a corner somewhere where, as comedy nerds, we all hated The Family Guy.
Sure.
And it feels like at a certain point, everyone was like, the Family Guy's actually not that bad. Well, I haven't gone back and revisited it.
That's the thing, is like, later seasons, they started dropping a lot of the stuff that that kind of made Family Guy what it was. In the early seasons, like, they don't do nearly as many cutaways. Like, they seem to
remember
be...
Remember the time? I can't
exactly.
do that accent.
But. But they seem to do, like, a lot more story-based, character-based.
Okay.
Still not American Dad, but what is... Okay.
I don't know. I don't watch either show. Not that I'm too cool for it. I just am too cool for television in general.
Why do you bring up Family Guy?
Because one of the great things that Family Guy has given to film discourse is the phrase, it insists upon itself, which is when they're dying or something. I can't remember. I haven't seen the whole episode. I've only seen the clip. And Peter wants to admit before he dies that he... thinks the Godfather is overrated because it insists upon itself. And it's like, it's very funny, and it's funny that it came from Family Guy, as far as we know. I've asked this question on the podcast before. If anyone knows if that phrase existed somewhere before that Family Guy borrowed it from, let me know, because it's a great phrase.
I have to assume that maybe one of the writers heard it from another writer.
Right, yeah.
At a party or something.
Yeah, because it is such a great descriptor of a certain kind of movie. I don't think The Godfather counts.
No.
But I guess I can see that it's kind of operatic. It's like based on a trashy novel, and it's like it does take itself kind of seriously, but it's also like cool and fun. I don't know. But I've definitely had that experience before of movies that I feel like insist upon themselves. Yeah. But for me, and I think, again, you and I are comedy people, a lot of times movies that don't have any laughs in them are the ones that are like, it feels like, no, we can't laugh at this because it's serious. Whereas, like, some of the great, like, dramas of all time, you know, Goodfellas, There Will Be Blood,
Fargo,
Citizen Kane, there's comedy in these. There are laughs in these movies, and so often it is a sign of a movie taking itself too seriously. But there are, I mean, everything's subjective. There are occasions where that kind of works for me.
Sure, of course.
I think 3 years ago when we did our top 10 and we do like underrated and overrated.
Yeah.
I think I said The Devil All the Time was the most underrated movie of the year because I could totally see someone doing the eye rolling and insists upon itself type of thing with that. But I feel like it reaches a level of like kayfabe almost that it works for me.
There is. Yeah. When talking about this, it's hard to pinpoint exactly what it is. Like, there's just kind of a vibe. And I would say that, yes, a movie being extreme, like, there's a difference between a movie being dramatic and a movie being dour. And I feel like this is not always the case, but I feel like a movie being particularly dour in a way that really, like, well, insists upon itself.
Yep.
I feel like that's pretty common for movies that like take themselves very seriously.
Yeah, it was. I mean, Arrival was a turning point for me, but it's Denis Villeneuve with Sicario and Enemy and Prisoners was someone that I didn't like his films for this exact reason. I felt that they insisted upon this, so they gotta stop saying.
Yeah, I liked those more than you did. However, Prisoners is the one that jumped to mind. Because it's just so, like, just visually, and the script and the performance is just, like, it just feels like a load of bricks that you, that he's unloading on you and you have to carry around.
Yeah, it's sort of like, I remember thinking, like, I said something to my wife after we saw it together. I was like, well, that was really unpleasant, but at least it was 2.5 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
On top of everything else.
And I recall you said, I'm not saying this like as a way of like saying you're repeating yourself. What I'm saying is like you said a similar thing about the movie Detroit, which I didn't see.
No,
but I remember you like, you can't, like the moment I asked you about it, you like rolled your eyes and you're like, well, it was really, really sad, but at least it was really long.
Yeah, That, I forget, have you seen American Fiction?
Yes.
Yet? Okay, so this isn't a spoiler, but it'll ruin one joke that I liked in the movie. There's a part where he turns on, it's not BET, but it's like something like BET. Yeah. It's like Black History Month, celebrating the beauty of the black experience. And then every clip they show is from like 12 Years a Slave,
yeah,
or like a drug movie, or yeah, like something like that. Like, that's what Detroit is to me. It's like, oh, we're going to make a movie about racism that's going to be 2 hours and 40 minutes of black people, yeah, being tortured.
Yeah.
That's how uplifting.
Yeah. It's like, well, I guess that is part of the experience, and an important one, but at the same time, you know, yeah, and I do feel like along those lines, well, let's do this. First, let's define what it insists upon itself actually means for us.
I mean, for me, it means the movie is not confident enough in itself or confident enough in the audience that it will get it, that it has to insist. It has, yeah, it has to lay it on thick. And that's why I said that, like, no laughing, this is serious, yeah, type of thing.
That's very interesting that you associate it with, like, a phrase, which is no laughing,
yeah,
this is serious. Because my phrase that I associate with is like, okay, you guys, come on, like that kind of thing, like, yeah, this is important.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, like, so when I thought, like, I thought a little bit of Denis Villeneuve, I thought a lot about Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
Who you like more than I do, but we, neither of us, like Shame really at all.
Yeah, that I didn't like 12 Years a Slave either. I mean,
yeah,
like,
me either.
Small X was the turning point. I mean, Widows, I think, I don't know, that's interesting because I talked about it being subjective. Like a movie, yeah, like The Devil All the Time, or another one popped in my mind and now I've already forgotten it, where it's like, it's so, like, knowingly, like, po-faced that maybe, yeah, you actually are kind of supposed to laugh. And
yeah,
I've heard that interpretation of Widows, is that, like, Widows, like, at times almost borders on camp. Like, you know, yeah, I think it was friend of the show and our friend Jake who said, like, come on, this is a movie that repeatedly has Viola Davis dramatically emerge from the darkness holding a small white dove.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there's an argument to be made that the movie does know what it is,
sure,
and is supposed to be kind of overly dramatic, which is how I felt about The Devil All the Time. I didn't get that with Widows, but maybe I'm too, yeah, dumb.
Well, I wasn't a big fan of Widows either because, like, I mean, the movie's not necessarily a genre movie, but there is an element to it. There's a genre element to it. And I feel like one thing, and I wish I could come up with more examples, but I feel like a genre movie that appears to be ashamed of the fact that it's a genre movie, and so it'll be like, I'm going to elevate this. I feel like, oh, you'll, right, find it with certain types of horror movies. I think people have accused Ari Aster of that. I don't think so. But,
well, yeah, especially not with Beau Is Afraid, which is,
like, yeah, yeah.
I mean, there are parts of Beau Is Afraid that I would say that's a comedy.
Like, oh, 100%.
Yeah, Birthday Boy Stab Man, come on. Which I think is my Letterboxd bio right now. I,
yeah,
tend to change it to movie references every once in a while.
But yeah, and so, yeah, there are certain filmmakers that I associate with this, who just really, I think an argument could be made that Inuyuritu has become this.
Yeah, I think that's a great...
Like I mean, I like Birdman, and I like The Revenant. Like, I think that, yeah, there's genuine artistic achievement there, but also it does seem to be like, hey, guys, check this out. I got stuff to say, which I don't begrudge a movie having something to say, but it's just that feeling of, like, yeah, there's just, like, a almost a school marmish tone to it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know. Like, it's, I'm going to keep repeating myself, but, like, it is subjective because sometimes there are movies that I really like that could be seen as, I don't know, humorless. Like, I like Alex Garland as a filmmaker.
Yeah, me too. Oh, I could see people saying this about Men.
I didn't see Men,
yeah,
but I was supposed to see Men. That was 22, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got COVID. That was the first time I got COVID.
Yeah.
I've had COVID twice. spring 2022 and spring 2023. So spring 2024, watch out.
Yeah.
Here we come. Anyway, so yeah, I missed then, but yeah, certainly Annihilation and Ex Machina definitely feels like it's like lesson based in a way.
Yeah.
I enjoy, like, yeah, I don't necessarily see, oh, yes, okay. Making a mental note to come back to something. Like, I don't see the lesson of the thing that Ex Machina has to say about different forms of male entitlement. Like, I don't see it as revelatory. It is pretty obvious.
Yeah.
But I just enjoy the sort of perverse pleasure Alex Garland seems to get out of punishing the men for it. That I, like, I do think there's something fun, not funny, but fun.
Yeah.
And I suddenly remember the other movie I was going to mention that was, like, on the surface humorless, but actually I think is, like, you know, tongue-in-cheek hilarious, which is Nightcrawler.
Sure.
I think that movie is very funny, not just for the Ellie references. I've talked about the argument between Jake Gyllenhaal and Riz Ahmed about Laurel Canyon versus Coldwater.
Yeah.
Since when is Coldwater faster? It has fewer lights, but Laurel has places where you can pass.
Yeah.
I think about it because I live in the Valley and work in Beverly Hills. I take both of those streets plenty. So I think about that a lot, but I do think there are a lot of other things in that movie that I find entertaining and funny.
Yeah.
But I could see someone, you know, thinking it's way too into itself or way too
I could see that. Like, I feel like most movies, they, again, like, it's hard to pinpoint exactly how a movie does this, but, like, when a movie, like, really feels like it's like, I'm gonna blow your mind, man.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like there's a quality to that.
Yeah.
Like, speaking of, like, another Jake Gyllenhaal movie that, as everyone knows, I hated so much, is Demolition.
Which I never saw.
Oh, my gosh.
He warned me away.
Boy, oh, boy. And that's one where it's just like, you know, it's a first-time screenwriter, surprising nobody if you've seen it. And because it's a first-time screenwriter, the movie feels like it has something to prove. And it's just borrowing from all these other movies and, like, combining them into like this one thing that the guy seems to feel like is really really exciting and really novel, and it just feels like, look, hey, anybody like myself who wrote like a screenplay when you were a teenager, I guarantee that was self-important and insisted upon itself, and that's what Demolition feels like.
Well, I think the one, because I think you and I have, well, that's not true. Sorry. This can't be fun to listen to. Me, like, battling it out with my brain.
Oh, sure.
And you're only getting one side of the conversation. I was going to say we've mostly been picking movies that people agree on. That's not true. A lot of people like the movies that we've talked shit about.
And Denis Villeneuve, like, there's a reason that he keeps making movies. And
but, don't I mean, he's, gotten,
he's doing well now.
I mean, although I had some of the same problems with Dune.
I was going to say that, yes.
But I really liked Arrival and
Blade Runner.
Blade Runner 2049 I really liked.
Yeah.
So yeah, he's proven that he can, you know, get to me. But Dune, I think like Damning with Faint Praise when I saw Dune was that I wasn't as bored as I was afraid I was going to be.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, the source material itself is kind of self-serious with, you know, and okay. I feel like
I never finished reading it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But like when David Lynch can't really bring much to it.
Yeah.
That's when, you know, like the source material itself is just going to drag people down.
But I'm going to throw out a couple that I think, well, one I've said on the podcast before, Lynn Ramsey's You Were Never Really Here is a movie that feels, luckily it's nowhere near as long as Prisoners, but it feels kind of like Prisoners and like, wow, this is just a gauntlet of upsettingness.
I've actually never seen it.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe you'd love it, because I like Lynn Ramsey a lot. I love Ratcatcher and Morven Keller. I never saw We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Oh, it's so good.
Okay. I'll add that to the many lists that I have. But you were never really here. I remember, and having that. Also, I've talked before about how much I hate that feeling. This is kind of like narcissistic of me. You go see a movie with a group of people, and afterwards, immediately afterwards, you realize they all liked it and you didn't, and you feel like, oh, am I going to be a spoil sport? But like, again, that's me being a narcissist. Like, you know, who says my opinion is going to spoil their opinion? They'll probably just think I'm an idiot.
Well, that's the thing is, like, apparently a lot of people, but like so many people, I've read so many people saying, oh, who are they to tell us what to think? It's like, no critic worth his salt is telling you should think this. They're just giving their opinion.
But I guess it's different when you're with critics, because they all have the... So I saw a critic screening of... I missed it at Sundance this year, but I saw a press screening of You Were Never Really Here. I was at the Wilshire screening room, and I walked outside afterwards along with two friends of the show, Jack Drew and Emily St. James. Mm-hmm. And they both really liked it, and I felt bad being like... That wasn't for me.
Yeah.
But I've had that. I mean, this is not an insist upon itself movie, but I remember seeing a press screening of Don't Think Twice. Is that what it's called? The Mike Birbiglia like improv like movie.
They're all
trying to get on Weekend Live and something like that. I did not care for that movie at all, but not an insist upon itself movie, just that I didn't think it was entertaining.
I remember when I went to see 12 Years a Slave, I went to a screening, and our friend Amy Nicholson was there, and as everyone was leaving, she and I, like, caught each other's eye.
Yeah.
And, like, warily approached each other, and, like, we unspokenly waited till everyone was gone. I was like, I didn't like that, did you? And she's like, no. And so we talked about it for a while, but, like, clearly we both felt like, man, I feel like I'm not allowed to not like this movie.
Yeah.
But it was such a relief knowing that someone else at that very screening did not really care for it. I think it gave me permission to write a less than sparkling review.
Yeah. I remember a couple years ago, I saw I guess it was maybe just last year. Natalie and I went to like a for your consideration screening of Romania's Oscar submission, which is a very, very bad movie called Immaculate. That is, again, at least it's short on the short side, but it's still just like, oh, this young woman gets like checked into a drug rehab, and over the course of the next 90 minutes gets like passed along from one man to another and repeatedly abused and raped and taken advantage of. And it's like, I just hate it. So it definitely is one of these type of movies.
Yeah.
But there was a reception afterward. And so I'm standing there. I have my like little cheese plate, my glass of wine. You know, I'm standing there. Natalie goes up to the bathroom. So I'm standing there it's like standing tables type of situation. There are two other women and they're like, what did you think of the movie? And I know like, probably half the people at this screening are in some way involved in the movie or in some way like from the Romanian government or whatever. Cause that happens when I saw AFI Fest this year, when I saw Io Capitano, the Italian entry, like half of the people in the theater were Italians.
Yeah.
Cause there's a part where the character who is not Italian attempts to speak Italian and half the theater started laughing. Anyway, I'm getting off track. So back to the Immaculate Reception. These women are like, what did you think? And I was like, oh, I danced around it. And then like, and then I realized they were also feeling me out. Yeah. So we were like, did you work on the movie? And like, once we'd established none of us had anything to do with the movie, we were like, okay, that was terrible. Right.
Yeah.
And then, so I'm talking to these two women and then Natalie comes back from the movie and they're like, what did you think? And Natalie looks at me and I'm like, it's okay. They had nothing to do with the movie. She's like, oh, thank God, that was terrible. So
I do feel like, you know, we were talking about dourness, and I do feel like maybe an offshoot of that is like movies that are just almost seem to be wallowing in misery.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, obviously 12 Years a Slave sounds like that one, Immaculate as well. I think a good argument could be made for Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah,
I mean, as much as there are elements I like, and Ellen Burstyn's great. Yeah, that's one, like, everyone's like, this is amazing.
I haven't revisited it. But it's one of those movies that, like, I saw, liked at the time, and I can, without revisiting it, I can already tell, like, I don't think I'd like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. I mean, obviously, like, there's some really great editing in there. The music's pretty good. So, like, it's not a terrible movie, but definitely, and I'd say this is kind of an element to Aronofsky in general, is there's, like, he's taking himself very seriously. Yeah. That doesn't stop me from really liking, I mean, I love Black Swan, and I feel like that could be one that people would easily say this about.
Yeah, but, I mean, I don't consider myself an Aronofsky fan, but the two that people say I should see are the two, like, or that I would like, are the two I haven't seen, which are Black Swan and The Fountain. Is that
what Yeah, it's called? I haven't seen The Fountain.
Yeah, I never saw either one of those.
I go back and forth on Mother. I feel like that, I think theologically it's a mess, and all this guy has to do is talk to, like, a first year, theology student to get rid of a lot of this stuff. However, I really like its audacity. I like the acting. I love the art direction. Yeah. Exactly. I feel like that exclamation point in a movie that is not The Informant could give you an indication.
Yeah.
Like, nothing insists upon itself more than an exclamation point.
You're reminding me, actually, of something that, this is getting kind of off the mark, but something that the aforementioned Emily St. James said on Blue Sky about Barbie this year, which is, she was like, to people who are steeped in feminist theory, Barbie probably seems really reductive.
Yeah.
But to people who aren't at all, it probably seems like it's articulating things that they've never been able to put into words before. So I think with something like Mother, it's like, you know more about theology than the average viewer. To the average viewer, maybe it does work as a kind of like gateway drug or a stepping stone.
Barbie, I feel like there could be an argument there. Granted, it's too funny.
I don't know.
Funny, but then, like, to me, it's like that America Ferrera monologue comes along and it's like, oh, geez.
But to talk like a Gen Z or about a sex scene, that monologue serves a plot purpose, as opposed to, like, it doesn't feel to me like the movie is putting on the brakes to make a speech. It serves a plot purpose, so that works. But again, like I said, like, the movie is not only too funny, it's too silly to insist upon itself.
I guess so, but at the same time, like, I would absolutely say that something like Vice or Don't Look Up insist upon themselves, and
those aren't funny,
right? But they're attempting to be.
So I guess this goes back to being subjective. Something, this is getting into television, but I often feel like I have to defend the show BoJack Horseman against people who have an idea of what it is. That it's like the sad horse comedy that has a lot of platitudes about depression and mental health and stuff like that. Mental health, it actually kind of, like, the show mocks the idea of, like, using mental health as a crutch at one point when Mr. Peanut Butter becomes hashtag sad dog. But also, I think what people who maybe don't know the show aren't realizing is that at the same time as it's a deep and sometimes troubling character study, it's also one of the silliest shows that ever been on TV. Sure. When I think about, like, one of my favorite episodes of BoJack Horseman, it's called Head in the Clouds, and it ends with this, like, really emotional knockdown drag out argument between BoJack and Diane about things that have been unsaid for, like, two seasons at this point. And it's, like, very raw and very character based, but it's also an episode in which a homemade sex robot called Henry Fondle talks his way to the top of the CEO, being the CEO of a streaming service, through repeated double entendres that are misunderstood.
Oh, that's
like
great.
It's the silliest show, and also it's this other thing. I mean, I feel like, again, with Barbie,
for my money, like, the silliest thing is when Todd, and Quentin Tarantulino are going to, like, make this movie, but, like, they keep changing the medium to something that's, like, more like the essence, and then they finally arrive at, like, a gift basket. Like, this movie, no,
it's a,
is that
a,
what it is?
It's a curated bi-monthly box of... It's a bi-monthly box of curated snacks.
That's right, and yeah.
Because I remember Todd says, like, I know it sounds confusing, but it's the bi-monthly that means every 2 months, not the bi-monthly that means twice a month.
Yeah, it's, yeah, I love that show, but there are some shows that I've stopped watching after one season because I got this feeling from them. One of them is Ozark.
I stopped watching after the pilot episode.
People love Ozark. There's good performances, but man, that thing just, I found it so exhausting.
Yeah.
And it felt, and yeah, it just, as opposed to like Sopranos or Deadwood or The Wire or whatever, yeah. Like movies that, like shows that are dramas that have to do with crime and that sort of thing. But those, it's not merely that they're funny, but also they just seem to like be aware enough of themselves to understand. I think that's the thing, is there's a certain lack of self-awareness to movies that are so serious.
Yeah, they don't know how they come across. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, the Danish Girl is one that I think of all the time. Oh, sure,
absolutely.
But real quick, back to what you were saying, I'm going to paraphrase because I can't remember the exact quote, and also Twitter being what it is, I can't remember who said this.
Right.
But basically, they were saying, like, someone was saying you can trace the downward slope from the... like new golden age, second golden age of American television through the difficult man dramas from Sopranos down to Breaking Bad, down to Ozark. Like you can see like a thing that was once revolutionary becoming more dumb and more rote as it goes on. Okay. What was I going to say? I had another, another contentious one that I got, back when I used to still write current movie reviews when I had time, maybe in 2024, New Year's resolution, I get back to posting regular movie reviews. One that we got a lot of negative comments on was that I wrote a negative review of Avengers Endgame.
Oh, right.
And I think I am not obtuse here. I understand that there are people who at that point especially were so invested in the Marvel Cinematic Universe that this 3-hour like slog felt like a big culmination of something that felt important. But like, I just always thought these movies were supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of fun with a lot of them. And so Endgame, because I was someone who would like, I like these movies. This is the same way I am with Star Wars and how I was able to like enjoy. This is the opposite of Endgame. Yeah. I was able to enjoy Rise of Skywalker because I'm not that invested. I just had fun for the 2 hours that Rise of Skywalker was.
Yeah.
And the same thing, I wanted the same thing out of Endgame, but it's 3 hours and there's almost no fun in it at all. Whereas the first half.
A little bit. I've rewatched it and there's more fun than I remember seeing the first time.
Yeah, maybe I'd get it more because, well, let's get back to something in a second. But the previous installment, the first half, Infinity War, is great. Like, well, I mean, up until the very end, which is very sad, it's like all fun. Yeah. It's so much fun. I've watched Infinity War multiple times because it's such a fun watch.
Yeah.
Obviously, up until it's very sad at the end. Yeah. I'm not gonna pretend that I'm so disconnected from the characters that I'm not sad at the end of Infinity War.
Right.
But it's very fun up until then. But yeah, maybe you're right that I need to revisit it because that certainly happened with The Irishman. When I saw The Irishman, I was like, man, this is good, but it's like, this is so sad and so heavy.
That's exactly how I felt.
But revisiting it, it still is, but like there is a lot more comedy, I think, in how dumb De Niro's character is, how malleable he is. And then also like the Harvey Keitel, the scene about the Chinese laundry, you know who owns the other half? No, I do. Who? No. I own the other half. Not I know who knows the other half.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot more funny stuff in The Irishman than I thought.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I mean, I didn't find Killers of the Flower Moon very funny. Maybe there'll be more gallows humor if I on a second watch. But I don't know.
There is some there's definitely some, like, yeah, some gallows laughs in there.
Yeah.
Like, De Niro getting mad about, like, the guy that was shot in the back of the head instead of the front. It's just, like, he's yelling at him like a manager of a store would yell at someone for, like, not mopping the floor right.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I forgot about it. I mean, Pacino in The Irishman is often hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
How much he hates John F. Kennedy is so funny to me.
And just, yeah, like, when he's talking about, like, there's the whole debate with Stephen Graham about, like, being late.
Oh,
man.
Oh, yeah, and I was thinking,
and how much, like, you can attribute to traffic.
And Stephen Graham is, like, you know, in New York, people are freezing their balls off. And he's like, no, it's August. And he's like, ah, I didn't realize. In my head, it's always 30 degrees in New York. I think about that all the time, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe I need to rewatch Killers of the Flower Moon. But I felt like I had something else, another example I was going to give, and now it's escaping me. So do you have anything else that was on your mind?
Yeah, I mean, so here's the thing. I think that when a movie insists upon itself, I think it actually gives itself a free pass to do things that other movies would be like, that doesn't feel right. For example, Free State of Jones. Did you ever see it?
I did see that.
Yeah.
Oof.
I mean, there's some good performances and stuff, but at the same time, it's just like, that is a movie that takes itself very seriously. So much so that there is a scene where Matthew McConaughey is, like, his character is basically an outlaw at this point. And he's working with, like, runaway slaves and all that. And so he gives, like, this big inspirational speech, and which ends with him saying, we're all N-words now. And I remember being like, wow, that is a choice.
Tone deaf.
Like, yeah. Totally tone deaf. Because it's also, like, I wanted, like, a guy to raise his hand. Be like, you know, we're like this because we were born like this. Yeah. You are like this because you made a number of choices. And it just, like, but clearly the movie thought it was doing something very important. Yeah. So it had no qualms at all with its main character saying that and believing that. I mean, it was crazy.
Yeah.
And similarly, Eat, Pray, Love. Did you see that one?
No.
Oh, my gosh, it's awful. And that's the thing. It's, like, similar to a movie that I increasingly consider the worst movie I've ever seen, Struck by Lightning. You know, these are movies that are so, they're so sure that, like, they've got the answer to everything that they ignore the fact that their main character is a fucking sociopath. Like, Julia Roberts' character, she's like, well, I just gotta be true to myself, and I gotta do this and that. And meanwhile, she, like, leaves all these broken relationships in her past and feels no need to apologize or explain herself.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I feel like you're maybe sending me the wrong message, but again, it's that lack of self-awareness that I think is pretty common with these movies.
These movies are so, like, sure that they're important or impactful that they don't realize how silly they can be sometimes.
Absolutely.
Like, Pay It Forward is a good example of that.
Oh, yes.
I think I haven't seen Life Itself, not the not the Roger Ebert documentary.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that. I also haven't seen Remember Me, which I know with Robert Pattinson. Do you know?
Oh, yes.
You know how that movie
ends? I know the twist of that one.
Okay, yeah, you can look that up for yourself. Yeah, so sometimes these movies, like, take themselves so seriously. Again, I guess I got BoJack on the brain because we talked about it, but Rami Malek voices a character who's, going back to TV, who is sure that he's a genius, like, showrunner and storyteller. He actually is just, like, it's all just, like, he's throwing up sort of, like, signifiers of importance, but he doesn't actually know what he's doing because Diane, like, tries to help him with the script. He's like, so is Mr. Peanut Butter's character a ghost or not? And he goes, exactly.
Yeah.
I would have absolutely kicked myself if we got through this episode and I didn't mention my bete noir, my arch enemy, the film director, Scott Cooper, who...
I knew you were going to cut, yeah.
Seemingly... And like, I liked Crazy Heart. Yeah. I didn't see Out of the Furnace. Is that what it's called?
Right. But, based on what I've heard, I feel like it's going to be what you're talking about.
Yeah. But, like, Hostels is so bad. Like, to... Like, it's so convinced of its importance again. Yeah. That, like, it end, like, it's... Like an infant getting shot in the like opening sequence. Oh. It's like, it's so convinced. Oh. It's like saying something important. And then like having Christian Bale be like a racist to the end, like stands up against racists to like, yeah, make sure the Native American characters get buried in the or like their bodies, yeah, happen. They get whatever sort of burial rituals they, yeah, have get done. It's just like, it's so self-important. And then like he made Antlers, which is a horror movie,
yeah,
and should be fun. Nope. That's I think that might be the like origin of what I was saying, like, no laughing, this is, yeah, serious. That's, yeah, what Antlers feels like. And then The Pale Blue Eye again,
yeah,
it's such like a pulpy premise, the Pale Blue Eye, yeah, which I don't know if you know what it,
I haven't seen anything after Black Mass.
So there's a murder at West Point, okay, in Pale Blue Eye. And Christian Bale plays an inspector who's brought in because he's supposed to be the most respected inspector, mm-hmm, to solve this murder at West Point. And he, there's a curious and ambitious young cadet at West Point,
yeah,
whom he enlists as his assistant,
yeah,
named Edgar Allan Poe. So it's...
wow.
I'm drawing a blank on his name from like Battle of Buster Scruggs, Harry Melling.
Okay.
Harry Melling plays,
well,
young.
I like him.
Yeah, and Harry Melling plays young Edgar Allan Poe. And again, this should be like a fun,
yeah,
pulpy gothic like detective story. Nope, it's got to be about like loss and regret and all this like
heavy shit. Oh, man.
Just like he can't seem to make a movie that is enjoyable to watch. I mean, Hostels at least is like, a lot of the cinematography is really good, and it's, yeah, got a great cast, but it's, I just can't. So yeah, Scott Cooper is the kind of the king of this. I can't believe I almost got to the end of the episode, yeah, without mentioning him.
Well, I did want to, like, I know we're almost done, but I did want to throw, like, well, let's talk about this, like, directors we love that might have done this every once in a while. Like, for example, we were talking about Scorsese, and I don't think The Irishman is this. I don't think Killers of the Flower Moon is this. I might think Gangs of New York is this.
Oh, I haven't seen it in so long.
Yeah, I rewatched it a few months ago.
I feel like that much scenery chewing can't help but be fun, but I don't know. Like I said, I haven't seen it since it was brand new, which is what, 20 years ago? What year is it? 2003?
2002.
Two, so over 20, yeah, years ago, yeah.
But like it ends where like you see like I think it's a great like a grave for one of the characters, and then like you see like time go by, and then you see like the city of New York get built up, and then you see like the full city right there in the background, and it's almost like, hey man, like think of the title and then look at this image and like, yeah man, this is where civilization came from. What do you think of that?
Yeah, oh yeah, of course everyone makes fun of the rat at the, yeah, end of The Departed, which I know some people have like tried to revise it as what I was saying, that it's like self-aware and tongue-in-cheek, but I still think the rat at the end of The Departed is very stupid.
Yeah,
The Departed is better than I thought it was when I first saw it, but I still think that's stupid. You know, and it's I don't know if this is just us, but like it feels like we've been talking about movies from like the 90s on.
Right, I was trying to think before that.
Well, I wonder if it's a deal of like time proving us right, where like,
right,
the self-important movies from the 50s, 60s, and 70s maybe mostly have like faded from memory, and the actually good movies are what stuck.
I feel like in my lifetime, Easy Rider has gone from a movie that's like this revolutionary classic to one where it's like, meh, it's kind of dated, and also like clearly thinks it's doing something.
Yeah, that
like
was my feeling, yeah, when I saw Easy Rider in high school. No, in college is when I saw Easy Rider. I didn't really like it, but I wonder if I would like its in a different way than Mother, if I would like its audacity and its go for brokenness more now. Because I like... I've since seen other... at the time that I saw Easy Rider, the only other Dennis Hopper directorial effort I'd seen was Chasers. But I've since seen the last movie and The Great out of the blue.
Did he do Colors?
Oh, yeah. I also since seen that. That's not a very good movie at all. That's, again, that thing like with Hostiles or Detroit or whatever. It's like... white people making movies about race that are like probably well-meaning but are so blind, so colorblind in many ways, that it ends up being insulting. I don't know. I like Maria Conchita Alonso.
Whatever happened
to Maria Conchita Alonso? How do you have a name that's fun to say?
Exactly.
And
I want to see a movie with Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio.
Yeah.
And Maria Conchita Alonso.
Let's throw Mary Stuart Masterson in there.
Exactly.
All right.
So I feel like Scorsese has done it. I love Orson Welles, but I feel like if you look at something like, well, frankly, I would say The Other Side of the Wind, which I loved.
Oh.
But I feel like an argument could be made that is, you know, I guess there's going to be... there is a difference between being like self-indulgent and self-important. Yeah. I feel like they do go hand in hand a lot.
I think,
but not
indulgence,
always.
And I think, like with Easy Rider, or like I'm assuming with Easy Rider, the filmmaking bravura in Other Side of the Wind makes it too engaging to be, because often these movies we're talking about that insist upon themselves are boring.
Yeah.
And I'm never bored by The Other Side of the Wind.
Yeah.
Even if it's not as funny as it could be. Although I don't think it's without laughs, especially in the early part, like the drive out to the place. There's like some funny stuff there. I think it's too fascinating in its filmmaking.
I think that's a great way to look at it, because there's a difference between a director saying, I'm making something important, and feeling like invigorated because of that, and a director saying, I'm making something exciting and new, and feeling exhilarated because of that. You know, there would be some people who would say that 2001 could fall into this category.
Yeah, but it's too gripping to me.
Yeah.
Too hypnotic to me. But some people, I could see some people finding it very boring.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, like, speaking of Kubrick, this is like 15 years ago, over 15 years ago when I first moved out here. I was a PA on something, and there was a part, I can't go into the whole thing, but there was basically, there was a part where, like, someone had to be on guard in front of this room to make sure, because everything was, like, set up. So it was like, we had to take shifts just sitting in front of the door to this room, making sure no one went in. So we would like watch movies I brought in like Kids and Hall DVDs. And at one point I was watching Dr. Strangelove and one of the sound guys stopped by. He was like an older guy or middle-aged guy. And he was like, I showed this to my kids recently. They were so bored.
Yeah.
I mean, tastes change.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen, on Twitter, I've seen people say that they find The Sopranos too boring. But those people who are used to Breaking Bad, where everything
every episode is,
Which that's something, Scott and I were talking recently on the podcast, or maybe on a Patreon, patreon.com/battleshipretention, about The Sopranos compared to Breaking Bad. And he asked me, he was like, I haven't seen it in a long time. Do Sopranos episodes end on cliffhangers like Breaking Bad episodes?
And
no. Like, no. They're
maybe
all like
maybe one or two
stories. I mean, the last one.
Yeah.
Maybe. I'm looking at Maria Conchita Alonso's filmography, and like she still works and has done a lot of TV, but I don't think I've seen her in anything since Colors.
Oh, really?
As a movie. I've seen, she did like an episode of Desperate Housewives, a few episodes of that miniseries Kingpin, if you remember that from the early 2000s.
Mm. I do know that series. I like the movie more.
They're not. They have nothing
to do with
what's
up?
It looks like she was in the movie Material Girls with the late Brittany Murphy.
Yeah.
Spread with Ashton Kutcher. I remember that movie. Never saw it. Lords of Salem, which was a Rob Zombie movie that I wanted to see she was in. But I just haven't seen her in anything. But she's got, like, TV movie credits up until the present day. So, good for her.
So, obviously, I feel like this conversation could keep going because I keep thinking of ones might qualify, like Falling Down, which is like Colors got me thinking about it, which is funny, but it does seem to be like making a statement or something.
But I still, I mean, Joel Schumacher has made some bad movies, but I still think that he has too much fun making movies for it to fully be like, Falling Down is probably really, really dumb. Yeah. I haven't seen it forever, but
I mean, I loved it when I was young. But I feel like,
and I'm sure I'd love it for the real life L.A.
Yeah, of course.
And not only is it real life, but it's like, for the most part, maintains geographical verisimilitude. Yeah. He actually moves from downtown to Venice. The ocean, like along notable landmarks and stuff. I'm still trying to think of your prompt about like a film director I like who has one or two of these, and I don't know. I feel like I'm drawing a blank right now.
But, like, I'll throw these out, not as, like, they're definitely this, but, like, as a talking point. I think someone could make the argument that Magnolia is this. Because it's just so full.
That's a great point, things. Because I think I would have... I didn't know the term back in 2000, but that's probably what I would have said at the time. Now I like Magnolia, even if I do get... having lived in the Valley, especially that part of the Valley, I get annoyed by how white Magnolia is.
Yeah.
Because that's not at all. This is a thing, Natalie and I talked about on my other podcast, The One Where I Met Your Mother, is that if you are not from Southern California, or you haven't been to LA or whatever, if you just know the San Fernando Valley from movies and TV, you probably think it's very white. Because that's what you see in, like, Fast Times, Ridgemont High, and what else? Like, Karate Kid and all these things. Like, in reality, the Valley is very heavily Latino.
Oh, like, yeah. I mean, like,
when I go into a store, they switch to English for my benefit, you know, in my neighborhood. Like, it's a very... Because Natalie, being from here, she asked, like, do you think some of the anti-Valley sentiment is... racist? And I said no, because people don't know.
No,
people
they don't.
Outside of this area don't know that it's mostly Latino.
When they say Valley Girl, they are not picturing a Latino woman.
Maria Conchita Alonso.
Exactly. I was just going to say that, but I mean, when I took classes about, like, you know, what it means to be a white person adopting a kid of a different ethnicity, and my boys are Latino, and they said, like, you know, it's like they may wind up being the only kid of their race in your neighborhood. And I was like, I don't think we need to worry about that. If anything, like, the kids might be made fun of by other kids for having white parents.
Yeah.
You know, instead of the opposite. But yeah, and then, like, I think about Christopher Nolan, and I feel like. Feel like Inception, maybe Interstellar.
I say Interstellar too. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Fincher, like, even though his movies can be funny, I feel like for a while he was someone that could, like, took things very seriously.
I guess I could see that like I was saying about Scott Cooper, that, like, Panic Room and The Game should be more fun than I thought they were at the time.
Yeah.
But again, I haven't revisited those. So I think
The Game is a lot of fun.
Okay.
Panic Room, not so much. But
Fight Club was one at the time that I was like, this movie is too interested in teaching. But I keep thinking these examples when I think, like, I'm probably wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't seen Fight Club in a long time, and I feel like I should probably revisit it. But we should wrap up.
Okay. Oh, I thought, I mean, I don't know if this is a director that I like, but I feel like Norman Jewison has made movies that I love, like Moonstruck, and then he's made, like, Rollerball and and the Thomas Crown Affair, both of which I think are dull as dishwater.
Yeah.
And partially because Rollerball is so intent on being this like very serious allegory of like, this is what the future could become.
It's one of those examples, like we talk about, like, hey, if you've got something to say, put it in a genre movie, and the genre elements will disguise it. Rollerball, not the case.
They won't let, you won't let it. But that's, of course, allows me to bring up my favorite trivia facts. The Thomas Crown Affair and Rollerball, both Norman Jewison movies, both remade by John McTiernan.
Oh.
Isn't that weird?
I think I forgot that John McTiernan did the remake of Thomas Crown Affair.
Yeah, that was back when he was still
not in jail.
That was pre-13th Warrior, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, because then there was 13th Warrior and Rollerball, and then he went to prison or something.
Yeah.
yeah.
But
all right. Yeah, I can also keep talking forever.
Exactly.
Fun
so, listeners, I'm sure you guys are thinking of tons of them.
Yeah.
So feel free to put them in the comments.
Yeah. 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 And you can email us at david@battleshipretention.com or tyler@battleshipretention.com. You can follow me on Twitter and Blue Sky at David Pretension. You can follow Tyler on Twitter at More Lessons. I'm on Letterboxd at David Backs. My other podcast, as mentioned, is the one where I met your mother. You can find that at Battleship Pretension, but or wherever you listen to podcasts. Tyler, anything else? Oh, yeah. Tyler's GoFundMe, which you can find pinned to the top of the homepage at battleshippretention.com. I got to get back in the habit of mentioning that.
Indeed. And many of you have been extremely generous.
Yeah.
And I really do appreciate it.
And again, I'll keep saying it. Like, if you sign up for the Patreon at patreon.com/battleshippretention, that is very much very similar to helping Tyler because he sees some of that money.
And we might need to cut this out. Did we ever make a decision about what Scott suggested for patrons?
Not yet. We can talk about it next week.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah. Good call. But we don't need to do that until January anyway.
Indeed.
That's it. Thank you for listening. Happy New Year.
Yes. Happy New Year. We'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.